Hi team, welcome to episode 12, season 1 of the Hansen Hour. The episodes are going on without unpacking a lot of the album, which was the first intention. So bear with me while we make our way through. This is a really, really special episode, and I know you're going to love it. We have Rhonda Bedikan. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Rhonda. Apologies. So I was introduced to Rhonda through Ravi, and Rhonda was Hansen's publisher very, very early on, from the mid-90s. And you'll hear a lot of incredible stories. We also really do a little bit of a chat about the music industry, or the music business industry, which is really enjoyable as well. Well, it was for me. I hope it is for you too. So I did put a poll in my stories about this episode asking who knew if Hansen had kept their publishing rights from the get-go, or at least with Middle of Nowhere. And it was pretty split, 50-50 said yes and 50% said no. So just to sort of outline that there is a difference between owning the original masters that the record company have versus, I suppose, where your melody and lyrics end up and what they're associated with. So they are two different branches of the industry. Rhonda had a little party at her house, which you'll hear about, which sort of starts off their relationship and starts off the story, which is really, really sweet and endearing. Rhonda was also the first woman that I had ever been put in contact with or had reached out to. And I wanted to speak to that a little bit as well, in an industry that is so very clearly male dominated. So we talk about that a little bit too. Rhonda was so giving in her time and so kind and thoughtful. And I just wanted to make note that when we hung up from the call, she was also the first guest that I've ever had on that said, or had asked what I do outside of this podcast, and wanted to know a little bit more about me and what I do, you know, for work, for a living. We shared a lot of really great stories. She'd been in Melbourne before on another tour, and it was really nice to be in someone's presence that was very genuine and very warm and very caring. And I can imagine that anyone that's associated with her would speak the same and feel the same. So enjoy this episode. Enjoy Rhonda. I will link you in the show notes where to find her if you so felt the need to reach out and say hello. I will see you next week. Rhonda, thank you so much for being here. I'm really, really excited about this one.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Funnily enough, we were set up by Ravi, who I've had on before. So he introduced me to you, and I would love to know a little bit about how you guys know each other and how that relationship is starting or finishing, going. How's it going?
When Mbop was released, they had a one of the local radio stations in LA did a in-store with them when they used to have record stores. And so they played at the store, and there was the upstairs area for people who worked with them. And so after the show, we were all having drinks and something to eat, and Ravi and I started talking, and we just really, really hit it off. And we have, he's such an interesting guy, and we have so much in common. So we have been to France together and Germany together for different projects. We just, even after he left Hansen, we still stayed very, very close. And, you know, I just adore Ravi.
Yeah.
He's so smart.
His podcast has charted so well from my analytics, and everyone has that same sort of feeling that he's just a really good, deep, like, guy. Well, that's lovely. Now, let's bring it back to you, and I would love for you just to introduce a little bit about yourself and what you do, because this is a Hansen podcast, but we don't always understand the sort of technical business parts of all that moving parts that go on behind a band. So I would love to hear a little bit about, who you are, what you do.
Sure. Well, when Sir Richard Branson sold his company in 1992, I had been the CFO for Virgin Publishing in North America. And an attorney came to me and said, why don't you start your own business? Because there are so many songwriters who need someone who actually understand the rights of the song, you know, the composer's rights and the publishing rights. And so he introduced me to some people, and I started my own business. And that was in 1992. And the same attorney called me, Bill Coben, in 1995. And he said, your daughter's 8 years old, right? And I said, yeah. And he's like, I'd like to have her have a barbecue and invite all the kids in her class and their parents. And I'll pay for the barbecue. And I'd like to see their reaction to this little group that I've heard of. So I was like, okay, so they came to my house and they played, and it was filmed, and some of it is actually in some different videos. There's a little background, you know, shots at my house. And I started talking with the dad, with Walker, and with their manager at the time, and about how songwriting was very important and those rights, and they got it. I mean, Walker had really studied the business, so did their management company. And when you control the rights of a song, when you don't sell those rights, you control if it goes into a movie, if it goes on to a TV show, you know, and they have, especially at that time, they had very strict moral beliefs. So they were concerned about it not being used in anything that they didn't think was aligned with their views. So that's kind of my background, what I do it for a couple of the guys, the original and still members in Earth, Wind & Fire, Ralph Johnson and Verdeen White, who was Maurice's brother. Maurice, of course, started the group. I've worked with Battle Cat, who produces most, he's Snoop's producer of choice. So I deal with a lot of rap because, you know, samples are such a big thing. A lot of people call me and ask me if I can help them get permission to do a sample, or vice versa. When Jay-Z did Song Cry, he sampled Ralph from Earth, Wind and Douglas's Gibbs song from 1972 in that song. And, you know, I gave them the rights. So basically, I work on the legal end. I make sure everything's copyrighted. I make sure we have deals in place worldwide so that we can, my writers can collect their money. And that's basically what I do when I do things for film and TV. Yeah. And sometimes I music supervise some films.
Okay. So if we were to look at something that we might sort of understand Now, what's happened with Taylor Swift, for example? So you're saying that early on, Walker in particular and the company really seem to have a good understanding of giving away their rights. Whereas, say, Taylor Swift in those early days, did she give away all her rights? And that's that point of difference, because we see her coming up in the papers a lot now about having problems with Scooter Braun, her publisher, that they have some sort of ownership over her music. Is that similar sort of vibe?
That is what she has problems about because she went and signed everything in the beginning.
Right.
She signed it
Sure.
off. See, the guys were signed to Mercury on Polygram, and they had the rights to put the masters where they want, but you cannot put the actual sound recording in a movie unless you have permission for the song. So when you have the composition rights, you own everything, and or you control where everything goes. Taylor Swift gave those up. So, I think she's actually gotten some back, but apparently her dad wasn't as smart as Walker. What can I say?
Isn't that incredible? And I think that that's why I make that sort of comparison, because I do find it really incredible to hear that they had that knowledge, and that probably was due to their belief system guiding them through every choice that they made, or everything that was put on the table to them, that they really were strongly guided by that value. But I do find it really interesting that they had that knowledge and that they were able to make that choice even back then,
Well, I think,
to
with
retain
the
their rights.
attorney they had was very smart. They got someone in Oklahoma who they were close with knew this attorney and knew how good he was. So I think he helped school Walker as to what he should do in the best interest of his sons.
Yep. So does that mean early on that there's less money on the table? Do they offer you like some really lovely looking shiny amount to sign all your rights away? Is that something that is usually a given? And then it's very strong to say like, no, I'm not taking the shiny objects.
Exactly. That's exactly what they did. But because right now, publishing is a bit different because you do not have physical sales. Back in 97, you still had physical sales. And you also need people overseas in different territories to collect the money that's earned overseas and pay it through to you. So in this case, I happen to know the head of Warner in Germany. He was an American guy. And we knew how big the buzz was on Hanson. So they had been offered a lot of money to give up their publishing. But this gentleman and I sat down with a pen and paper, figuring out what we thought they would probably earn. So I was able to actually get them more overall in the world to keep their publishing than they had
Wow.
been offered. And they had been offered a huge amount of money. But we stuck to our guns and everybody was happy. So, and it's
Yeah.
not like these people didn't earn their money back. You have to pay back what they give you as an advance. And the guys sold 13, 14 million copies worldwide. So everybody got their money back. No one was unhappy.
Isn't that incredible? It just goes to show you like it works out anyway in the end, and you get to maintain those rights.
Exactly. I
So
just went through a thing with one of Alice Cooper's people who's been a very good friend of mine. There's something called reversions, where after 35 years in the United States, you can get your rights back, but there's a very specific way you have to give them notice between 2 and 10 years before the 35 years are up. I mean, there's a whole process to it. But we've gotten his stuff back now. So now he owns it, and he never owned it before. He didn't realize back then what he was giving up because somebody gave him a lot of money.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. And I feel like too nowadays, especially with Taylor Swift's media, like I feel like you would know a lot more now moving into it. It was a very particular like era, that music industry in the 80s and 90s that was going on. So there's two things that I want to talk about. First of all, what was the reaction to, like, what was the children's reaction to the band at your house at the party?
Loved them. And then all the kids went swimming together, you know, in our pool. We had a barbecue and they all had a great time. You know, they're very personable. They're very smart. Even that, you know, Zach was always the crazy one, you know, and he was the littlest one. So he was doing cannonballs in the pool, you know, and they just had a really great time, but they loved the music. And we actually, I think I wrote to you that we had some people who actually climbed up trees over our fence to take pictures. They didn't know who was playing, but the music was so good that these people came and were taking pictures. We chased them away, but
that's it. See, that's incredible to hear. And what sort of, how were they playing? Was it like a cappella? Did they have like their little shakers and tambourines, or was it a full setup?
It was a three-piece setup at that time. That was, you know, before Ravi, before they were signed. And we actually also invited over some A&R people that we knew. Right. And Warner Kids Division wanted to sign them, but from that party. But, you know, it wasn't the deal that everybody thought they should have. We wanted to wait a while longer, or they wanted to wait a lot longer. I wasn't really involved at that point other than as a friend. And, you know, and then Steve Greenberg heard them, and the rest is history.
Yeah. So we had Steve on, and actually I do have a question about this since where Steve has come up. When Steve was on, he mentions that Hanson recently put out a Christmas album, and I'm not sure how much you follow the band now, but they, after the Island Def Jam dissolved or there was something, they're now independent, and they have their own company called Three Car Garage, which they put their music out through. But Steve was on and he said something really interesting that I didn't push on, but I would really love to hear your opinion. He said, because, you know, the Christmas album came off of my, because Steve's got a label called S-Curve Records. Right. And he said, the Christmas album came off of my label. And I was thinking that's strange in terms of publishing and things like that. Why would they put their Christmas album through Steve's label instead of their own? Would it have something to do with territories or what they want?
He may have distribution that they liked. You know, I also think they, you know, they like Steve. Look at Steve, you know, did a lot for them. So
yeah,
maybe there is a sense of loyalty there. You know, I don't know.
Right. Sure, you because know. Maybe it's not their own music, because I think that it was, you know, Christmas songs.
Right,
so, yeah, that would make more sense than something that was theirs and that they had ownership of, and maybe Steve could get it out to a wider audience or something like that. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
And Steve is the great guy with siblings, you know, especially three sibling groups.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Isn't that incredible? And Taylor Hanson also did a side project called Tinted Windows with a couple of other famous people, and that also went through Steve's label. And it wasn't until Steve had sort of just casually mentioned it that I thought, oh, it's so funny to be a fan of a band and just sort of, you know, be along with it all, but the underneath, oh my gosh, like the all that sort of underbelly is just wild. Steve, I'm exhausted.
Amazing. Steve has great ears, but particularly for although I mean he's got like the Baja Man and you know other things, but you know, the sibling, he loves sibling harmonies, you know. And I don't know if you had it over there, but here a couple of months ago, the Recording Academy, who does the Grammys, put out a salute to the Beach Boys. Did you guys get that?
So we may have got it, but not like you guys did. Like there would have been like one small cable channel possibly, but because I'm deep in the Hanson fandom, I've seen all the footage and seen all the marketing and stuff for it. So I was very aware of it, but I haven't actually seen it.
Well, they did Barbara Ann, which is a Beach Boys song that has the sibling vocals in it, you know, the sibling harmonies. It was the perfect, perfect song for Hanson to do to salute the Beach Boys.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I actually have had a guest come on who is very well versed in, it's hard to explain, like harmonies. And she mentioned to me something that I hadn't realized, is that sibling harmonies have a particular vocal chord match, which is why it sort of works, where when you have people from all, say, like three different singers that aren't vocally aligned like that, which I found incredible. And because she studied the Beach Boys and stuff a lot as well. And I had never even considered that or taken that into account, that there was a vocal thing going on that made the harmonies so lovely. Yeah.
Absolutely. The Jonas Brothers have it too. You know, and what is that other band with the initials, AJS or AEH?
He does that too, doesn't he? Yeah, I wasn't sure who they were when he was talking about, and I was sort of like, oh yeah, because I didn't want him to feel like, yeah, but I'd actually never heard of them, but he was talking about them as well. Yeah, which is just, it is really incredible. So when we first started talking, I mentioned something to you, and this is a slightly off Hanson topic. Actually, it's like a completely off topic thing, but I'm personally interested in it and it's my podcast. So I'm just gonna. So I said to you, oh my gosh, it is so nice to be talking to a woman. And I don't know if that is unusual for you because you are in the industry, but from my point of view, every single person that I've reached out to has been male. Every backup singer or musician, sessional musician, whether in the studio or otherwise on stage, every recording producer, everything has been male. So when you popped into my little stratosphere, I thought, oh my God, a woman in the industry, is that rare? And especially back when, say, in 92 or the early 90s, were you an anomaly or is it not?
I think I still am. I was really lucky. I worked for Chrysalis, and which, you know, was owned by Terry Ellis and Chris Wright. And the American, although she was British, the American president of publishing was a woman, Ann Munday. And, you know, so it was great having that role model. And Billboard did an article about the power women in the industry. And I think there were only six women. This was in the 80s. And Anne was one of them. And Sylvia Rhone, who's still a power player in the industry. But there are very few. A very misogynistic thing. Look at what Taylor went through. Taylor Swift, yeah. Not Hanson. You know, and right. You know, it especially the record side, publishing a little less so. And, you know, there's some really great dynamic backup singers. One of the things I love is Pink. When Pink does a concert, she'll give credit to everybody. She'll have a rolling credit list of the roadies, everybody. But she has a particular backup singer, Jenny Douglas, who is amazing. She's also done backups for Bruce Springsteen. She's done a lot of stuff. And then you have people like Mary Clayton with the Rolling Stones, you know, who did Gimme Shelter, and Darlene Love, who are incredible backup. Have you seen 20 Feet from Stardom?
No, but I know it. Yeah.
That's a great movie to watch because it's mostly the female backup singers. But, you know, it is like most industries, it's misogynistic, you know?
I'm hearing that and I'm seeing that, and that's been really eye-opening for me as well. And even I don't believe that Hanson particularly had a target market, them in particular. I can't say, I believe that their management probably did and Steve probably did, because he said that originally he picked up a magazine and it had Jonathan Taylor Thomas on the front, and he said, oh, you know, I wonder if we can get something like that to be in the music industry. And sometimes I've got to wonder how much of a commodity I was based on my sex as a female to buy, how much they're playing to that. And it's been interesting now seeing that, and then the fact that most of the industry is dominated by males. You know, I want my money back.
It was very funny. I took my daughter and a friend of hers. We went up to San Francisco from LA to see Hanson and to visit. And we were staying with a friend of mine who is a singer, Jay King. He had a singing group called Club Nouveau. He's Black. He had his two sons there, and they were around my daughter's age at the time. She's probably 15 or 14. And I said, why don't you come to the Hanson show with us tonight? And they were kind of like, and I was like, you know what? These two young Black males, I was like, you will be surprised. Plus, there's all these girls there. The audience is almost all girls. So they were like, okay, they came to the show. They went back to Diana backstage and they said, we are so impressed. We're going to tell our friends how great these guys are, because they're incredibly talented. You know, they really are. They're great songwriters. They're great musicians, you know, and wonderful singers. But, you know, you have to see it. You know, if you just listen to Mbop, and that's your knowledge of Hanson, you know, you're going to get a different view than if you see them in, you know, in a concert.
And I think that's what wins everybody over. And obviously, you know, you've got people climbing the fence at your place to see what this amazing thing is. And I think if you can get someone there, even my husband is a great example. You know, he's been, I suppose when we first started dating, I mean, we've been married for, I don't know, 15 years or something now. And he comes to all the shows because he loves it. He didn't know what to expect the first time. I think he probably did come as a joke, but he loves like Ryan Adams and all these sort of singer-songwriter things. And he very much has Hanson on that same level, an understanding of what makes a great song, what, you know, is talent. And he loves it.
But you've got to get them there. I have heard that from so many women your age, because they grew up loving Hanson. And sometimes I will teach publishing, and I was teaching at LA Recording School and Film School. And one of the guys there was like, you know, my wife's really into the group, and he said, when she dragged me kicking and screaming to one of their concerts, it's like, I was so impressed with them. Yeah. I love them. And look at even that first album they wrote with Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann, you know, and got rest in peace, Cynthia. But I mean, they were established, really great songwriters. You know, they wouldn't have written with them if they didn't like their talent. You know, they yes. saw something in them and were willing to work with them. And yes, says a lot.
You were also at one point, director, I believe, tell me if I'm wrong, director of royalties at Capitol?
Is International that royalties, yeah.
International royalties. So when we see movies, when, like, again, it's a male, but regardless, I'll stop with that, who is, like, wrote this one great hit, right, this one time in this movie and now lives off the royalties. Oh, you know, like Charlie Sheen on that show.
Two and a half men.
I'm pretty sure he falls into this category. Is it possible to live off of royalties if you have a really massive hit?
You know, it's very funny, but you can. There are people who have written one song, and that's because they own the publishing, you know, or right. they've kept a good portion of the publishing. I had a boss who wrote half of the song That's Life by Frank Sinatra. That song's played everywhere. It was copyrighted wow. in 1964. And that man, I think, always earns six figures a year, if not more, from that song. Oh, wow. Because it plays, there's a Frank Sinatra station on Sirius FM radio here. It plays worldwide. Earth, Wind & Fire, the song September, plays everywhere in the world, every like minute and 38 seconds. It's like crazy.
Wow.
And you know, that's the one thing. If you, you know, own those rights or at least have a piece of those rights, you know, you can earn decent money. You yeah. know, you really can.
What sort of things were coming Hanson's way in terms of who was wanting their music for something? And would there be any like royalties still coming in for, say, like Mbop or something?
Oh, totally. Because, you know, when I think it was Hangover 2 or 3 that has a scene with it, every time that gets played on TV, they have, you know, that they will get some publishing royalties from it. And they had songs in so many different movies and TV shows and things like that. When those TV shows go into repeats or they go overseas, you know, they're still making their money from it. But okay. it's funny that you ask about Hanson because yeah. of how they felt about things. I had three-inch binders of things we turned down because wow. they didn't like the particular subject or they didn't care for the scene it was in. I was the gatekeeper, and I would go to Walker and say, this is what we have. How do you feel about it? And if he said yes, I would say, well, I think we can get X amount of dollars. But if he said no, that was it. And the record company was so sad because if they controlled the publishing, they would have put it in every piece of garbage, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, which is really good to look back on because I think that can water down something and someone, you know, if it has that sort of saturation. And I really think, oh, actually, we talked about this. I really think that was one of the best things that they did in terms of the longevity of them and their band and their fans. And you had mentioned too that they had said to you that keeping their publishing and doing like Mo and their fan club and their website and the stuff still to this day is one of the best things. Yeah.
They collected email addresses when people were not doing that. You know, it was a whole new field. And that was a lot of their management company at the time. I mean, these guys were very technically savvy, and they put that together for them. And it's still, you know, they still keep in contact with their fans, you know?
Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
And that's important. I mean, and they had some crazy fans. I mean, my daughter and I, one time we were coming out of a show, also in San Francisco, and we heard somebody go, "Oh, that's their cousins." And I'm like, okay. And then we were in New York for, I want to say it was for the Grammys in 98, but it could have been for something else they were doing. I know they did Conan O'Brien nighttime show, and we were there, but we were all in the same hotel, and the fans would follow us because they thought we were going, they knew we had something to do with Hanson, and they were following us because they thought they would lead us to it. And at the Beacon Theater, when they did Tulsa, Tokyo in the middle of nowhere, the part at the Beacon, they were very sweet and gave my daughter and my niece the seats in the first two rows. And Tay had come out and said hi, and he leaned over and he's like, "Hi, Denise." And he like pulled on her hand. And this girl next to her punches her in the stomach and says, "He's mine." It's like, are you out of your mind? I mean, they were fanatical, these kids.
That's so sad. Oh my gosh. I hear that. And I really feel, again, looking back at it, how much, and listening to Ravi, to how much that really sort of affected them, I think, and how that the sort of bubble had to get even tighter because of that, because, you know, there was so much crazy and so much fanatic that by all accounts nobody really saw coming to the level that it did. So that at Walker especially,
I had a discussion with my daughter before Mbop was released, because when I worked at Motown, I was very close with Chico Ross, who is one of Diana's brothers. And Chico told me that growing up, he couldn't trust anybody, because almost everybody who wanted to be his friend wound up, they wanted to get to Diana. He said it was really hard. So I sat my daughter down. Now, at this time, she's 11 when the song came out. And I sat her down. I said, "Look it, you can be a fan of their music. I know you like their music. And, you know, if you go crazy when you're in the stands, that's one thing." I said, "But when you talk to them, and more than anything, their younger siblings, you have to be their friend. You are not a fan. They've got enough fans. You know, they need to know that they can trust you." And the day the song got released, my daughter, fourth grade, comes home from school, throws her backpack down and says, "I know exactly what you mean. I had no idea what she was talking about." And I said, "Excuse me?" And she said, "Remember what you told me about Hanson?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "All of a sudden, all the popular girls in school who wouldn't give me the time of day beforehand want to be my best friend." She's like, "I see what you mean, Mom." So she always kept that close. And that Christmas, the same radio station, it was Kiss FM, who had done the opening show for them in LA when it came out, did this Christmas show. There's an amusement park called Knott's Berry Farm, and they would have big Christmas acts. And we had to go down there. I had some paperwork that I needed them to sign. So we went down at Christmas time, and they had a little thing in the hotel room, a little, you know, food for us and everything. And when the guys walked in, and saw her, you know, they started talking to her, and the manager called me up the next day, and he was like, "Rhonda, the guys were so happy." He said, "Do you realize that's the first time in 8 months that they talked to a girl their age who wasn't screaming in their face?"
Yeah. Yeah, incredible to hear
Absolutely.
that.
And they're younger siblings too, you know, because people would, because they were young, people would try and latch on to them as well, you know, and we were always very protective of them.
Yeah, I can totally see that and understand. Let's shake off, but there, we'll move on from it. I wanted to hear a little bit of the story, which I had grabbed from another interview that you did, about someone, I don't particularly know if it was you, but someone had to go to court to get something signed because
That
they were
was me.
minors. Yeah, that
Yes,
was you. Okay. Yes, I want to
that
hear
was
this
me.
story.
Because in the United States, you know, in most states, well, actually, in all the states, if you're under 18, you cannot legally sign paperwork. You know, if your parents sign it when you become 18, you can negate it. And if you sign it, it has no legal standing at all. However, if the courts do what they do, they deem you as majors instead of minors. And because I had gotten them a very good deal in Europe with Warner, and Warner is a major corporation, you know, and they saw it was a very advantageous deal. And I don't know how, apparently we got some judge who understood that this allowed them to keep their rights. But she was like, "Well, obviously, you know, this person knows what she's doing. We'll give them the rights as majors to sign this and deem for this one contract they are majors, and we'll allow this woman to sign contracts on their behalf." So that's how that happened.
Yeah, that's incredible too. 'Cause there was something too about you were at Livid, or you were at a festival, like a major
Needham.
festival with someone. What was
Needham.
it? Oh, reading. Yeah,
No,
yes.
Needham. MIDEM.
Oh,
It's in Cannes,
okay.
and it's a music festival that goes on every year in Cannes. It used to be in the winter, but now they have it, I believe, right after the film festival there.
Okay, and you had had to meet with someone there,
I met with
and
my old boss, the head of
that's
Polygram
right.
Publishing, and I told him I represented Hanson. And he said, "Oh, that's nice." And I could tell by the look on his face that he had no clue who Hanson was, which was pretty embarrassing considering how much buzz there was about Hanson. You know, so then I guess you're referring to that story about I got a call from the head of the
Yes.
company in US asking why I hadn't spoken to him about Hanson. And I told him, "Well, actually, isn't your boss, you know, this gentleman?" He said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, I distinctly remember telling him at Needham that I represented them." And here's your misogynistic thing, because and he called him back. He said, "Do you know Rhonda?" And he's like, "Of course." And he said, "Did you see her at Needham?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Do you remember what she said?" And he said, "No, she's some woman who worked for me." And he said, "What she said was she represented Hanson."
Oh
So he got out of trouble because it was
my.
obviously he had been yelled at and it wasn't his fault. And so I wound up, and I told him I would only negotiate with his boss, which I did. And his boss didn't want to give me what I wanted. So I told him, "Okay, I can get that other places. If you don't have it, you're going to look stupid. And I'm leaving the office now. If you want it tomorrow and you call me, it's more money." And he got really mad because I knew he had a bad temper. I knew that from working for him. And he hung up on me, so I left my office. And the next morning I came in and the phone was ringing. And I said, well, it's more than yesterday. And he said, fine.
So good. I love that story. And I think it really speaks to how much of a powerhouse you are as well to put that kind of deal out on the table. Like, good on you. Good on you. So when did your relationship, I'll call it a relationship, a working relationship end? How did that come about?
Well, unfortunately, with Napster and with all the file sharing, the money was really not not flowing for everybody, not just Hanson. Also, the whole PolyGram being bought by Universal and being put with Def Jam Island, which was not the right label for them at all. You know, it was just a mess. And, you know, I love them. I emailed with Walker. We were talking when Cynthia passed. You know, I still keep a relationship because people will come to me because they need something Hanson. So I'll go to Walker and tell them, hey, you know, I mean, we still have a great relationship, but it was just at that point in time, it was easier to let them take care of it. And they knew the business more then. And, you know, one of the things about publishing is the accounting is ridiculous. You can get $2 for a song from here. And somebody who's got, you know, I had clients who had hundreds of songs and it just wasn't worth doing it. So I restructured my business. And now what I do with my clients is we make sure that the money comes in from the different places to them and my portion to me, so that I don't have to account to them. You know, it's way easier.
Yeah, you know? It sounds full on. Like, if you're, I'm like, who is counting every time something gets played? Like, that's wild.
Well, luckily, I have a company that I work with called Exploration.io. And it's actually founded by a woman and a man, Renee Meredith and Aaron, I think his last name is Davis. He's more the tech guy. But their company, they have a staff that knows how to find every penny. And they are really amazing. You know, they do mostly publishing and they have tentacles worldwide. They have relationships worldwide. So we use them. I just love them to death.
It sounds amazing. I've got two more questions before we wrap it up. You mentioned that if people still want something Hanson related, they come to you. In those instances, are they looking at Hanson things from the 97 era earlier on, or are they just wanting to get in touch with you to ask to use something even further down the track? What's been popular?
Well, they'll come to me because they have no idea who else to go to. And it's people who don't understand how you look things up on I know the performance societies in America, there's four, but they're at CSAC now. And, you know, you can go there and it tells you clearly who to contact. And these people don't know, but they heard somewhere that I worked with them and a lot of people know me.
Yeah.
So they'll call up because they either would like to do, they want to hire them for a show or they'd like to do something for a movie or whatever. And I just hand it to Hanson's company and, you know, 3-car garage, make sure they take care of them.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. And are you still a fan? Do you still get to check them out or have you checked them out recently?
Absolutely.
Or your daughter?
I have not seen them in a while, but I do want to go as well as my daughter. What's funny is I have a lot of family in Belgium, and my one of my cousins, she was a year or two older than my daughter, came to America right when Hanson's management was getting married, one of the managers. And Hanson was playing in San Francisco, so we went up there to see them, and the guys were all groomsmen in the wedding. And it was a
Really?
very small wedding in the Redwood Forest, the Sequoias. It was
Oh,
gorgeous. And we all hung out all weekend. And she emailed me the other day and said, I went to see Hanson in Brussels, I guess it was a few months ago.
yes.
But the last time I saw them was when they were still with ASCAP Performance Society. They were doing a private showcase. They had Valerie Simpson, who wrote Ain't No Mountain High Enough with her husband Nick Ashford. They had several people who were doing a night of great songwriters, and the guys were on it. And that was the last time I've actually seen them in person. So I've got to get to one of their shows, but now I travel back and forth so much, I have to be in one place to go. And my daughter loves them, but she's really into metal. She's going to see Metallica twice in August.
Oh, that is so
But she's
funny.
going to see Earth, Wind, and Fire tomorrow night, so.
Well, she'd have a special spot in her heart though for those bands, I think.
I have a picture of, we took Hanson to the House of Blues. They wanted to see the Spin Doctors were playing there. This was before their album came out. And the House of Blues has a foundation room for members. It's a private area. And so I was a member, so I took them up there. And I have a picture of Zach hugging Denise, like his arms around her. They're like, 10 and 11. And it was adorable. But Taylor wrote a note to the singer of the Spin Doctors and said, you don't know who I am, but my album's going to come out soon and you're going to know who I am. And gave it to the singer. I'm
This
sure he looked at it and just said, yeah, this kid's nuts.
That is so funny. This has been so brilliant for all your stories and like little anecdotes. Writing a note to the spin doctor.
They
You
love the
just
Spin
topped
Doctors.
it. My favorite story so far in this whole podcast. I love that.
Zach will probably, I mean, Tay will probably kill me when he sees me for telling the
No one's
Thank
we
you.
really,
Thank
really
you.
appreciate
One
it.
other quick
It's
thing,
been amazing.
Taylor is the president of the Recording Academy chapter in Texas. I don't know if you knew that.
I did, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, which is so how do you get something like that, and what does that mean?
Okay. Well, it's the Recording Academy really fights for our rights and or the rights of the artist and songwriters and engineers and producers. And there are, I want to say, between 12 and 14 chapters all over the US. I belong to the LA chapter. You have to be nominated, you have to be, referred by two people and blah blah. But they raise money for things. They go to Congress and fight for our laws, like now trying to fight to get more money for streaming for the writers and the artists. That's actually what he does a lot of. And each chapter has a board of governors, and there's of course a national board, but each chapter is very active. A lot of times they'll have screenings of movies that have to do with music, like we screened Walk the Line, you know, with Reese Witherspoon about Johnny Cash, and we did Straight Outta Compton, you know, so they'll do things that are really music oriented. Hired Gun, which is a great film. It's a documentary about side guys in the industry by Franz Stein. Oh, wow. And it's a really good movie. So they'll do things, they'll have, you know, nights for, you know, where they'll have different guests come and talk about their things. Mel Brooks came down and spoke one time, which was really interesting. You know, they just do things. And then, of course, they have Music Cares, which helps artists in trouble. Like after Katrina, it helped get a lot of the New Orleans musicians get new instruments and, you know, different things, or if they're in trouble, medical trouble or whatever, helps pay for things. So it's a really good organization.
Yeah. And thank you so much for explaining that to me and to anyone else listening. Could just be me, but I genuinely had no idea that that's what it was about. I thought, do you want to know what I thought it was?
Sure.
I thought it was. And this is not researching. This is just purely from the name of it, right? I thought that when the Grammys, oh my God, I can't believe I'm going to say this. When the Grammys came around, that they were given a list of nominees and it was up to each chapter to choose who won the award at the Grammys. That's what I thought it
all
was.
All of the members vote. All of the members vote. There's about 8,000 voting members. And I am not a voting member because I'm a professional member, because I'm not on a record. I'm not a musician or a producer or anything. And everybody gets to vote on the four or five, you know, like record of the year, new artist, stuff like that. But then you get to vote within your specialty, like engineering or whatever it is. And then you get maybe four or five votes where you can vote in different categories and you can pick what you want to vote for. That's how that works.
That's basically how that works. Yeah, I didn't realize that there was so much happening behind the scenes with those chapters. Thank you. That was happening and that was what a part of it was, which is just incredible. So you're based in Florida, but you are part of the LA chapter. And
well, I've been in LA for 46 years and I probably spend half my time in LA. And I just happen to be here now.
Okay, gotcha. Taylor's from Oklahoma,
and Oklahoma is part of the Texas chapter because geographically they're next to each other.
I didn't know that. That's what that I was trying to like see a map of America in my head, but I've never been very good at it. But I know from movies what Middle America is, and I believe that's Oklahoma is a part of that. So I didn't know where Texas fell,
it's
but I probably
south the middle.
Together, right. Okay. Oh, that's really, really interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that, but it sounds so Taylor-esque. So thank you for sharing so much of your
knowledge. Thank you for having me.
Don't hang up. Stay here. I'm going to push stop, but I'll say goodbye to you properly.
Okay.